The Great Bible Reset is a podcast devoted to counteracting the great economic reset of Klaus Schwab using Bible lessons and theory. Thank you to Boomers-Alive.com for sponsoring this podcast and the Kingsway Classical Academy. This week, we are continuing our study on the great books of Western civilization and their effect on our current economical and spiritual crisis. And now your host, Oliver Woods.
All right. Well, welcome, everybody, to the GreatBibleReset.com. Our thesis, the drum that we beat on constantly, is the idea, the fact that the only thing that will deliver us from the precipice of God's judgment that we're facing in America today is a return to His law, and in particular, the summary of His law in Exodus 20 through 24. But this idea of returning to God's law is almost considered heresy these days in America. We even our Christian population thinks in terms of getting back to the original intent of the Constitution and not the law of God. They claim that many of the founders never intended to separate God and state. And so today we want to look at especially Article 1 and how it relates to that and what it means. What does it mean to have no establishment of religion? Again, we have Pastor Weiland with us, Pastor Ted Weiland, who pastors a church in Nebraska. And so, welcome, Pastor Weiland. Maybe you could tell us just a little bit about what's going on there, what you're doing in terms of the ministry of with your literature, and not only in your church, but beyond as well.
All right. Well, thank you again for having me, and again, especially because it's this subject that we're talking about, which is, as I mentioned in one or both of the previous interviews, that this is the cutting edge of getting us back to where we need to do. This issue of the Constitution being biblical, when in fact it's biblically seditious, has to be dealt with in the hearts and minds of those who have good intentions for America, but are pointing people back to the Constitution, the biblically seditious Constitution, the reason America finds herself on the precipice today, rather than back to God as sovereign over the nation and His biblical laws as supreme as it was in the early 1600s. And so I've written a book called Bible Law versus the United States Constitution, The Christian Perspective, in which I devote a chapter to addressing every article and every amendment, examining it by the Bible. And when one does that, rather than cherry-picking the constitutional framers and other founders' quotations, rather than doing that, when we examine the Constitution by the Bible, we find that it's anything but biblically compatible. There's hardly an article or amendment that's not biblically egregious or seditious against Yahweh and His morality as found in His law. So that can be found. Of course, I've got the book. It's about a 575-page book as well, but we've also have a web page called Bible Versus. That's Versus spelled out, V-E-R-S-U-S, BibleVersusConstitution.org. And if you'll go to our online book and article page, you'll find nearly all of my 30 books. They're available on the website that you can download free right there. And I also make my books available free of charge. If you want the books themselves and cannot afford the suggested donation, that's all it is a suggested donation. But if you will use them for yourself or for someone else, I will send them free of charge, even if you can't afford the suggested donation. So, but also take advantage of, on the right-hand sidebar, there's a 10-question Constitution survey, and you'll definitely, if nothing else, if you will fill out that survey, I will send you a complimentary free copy of the 85-page primer of Bible Law versus the United States Constitution. We kind of realize that a lot of people, 575 pages is a little bit daunting, so we slimmed it down to 85 pages and dealt with the most important things in it. So you'll get that free of charge regardless if you want any of the other books as well. So that's probably the best place for me to be introduced is there on our website. Again, that's BibleVersusConstitution.org, and be sure to take the Constitution survey.
All right. Yeah, well, thank you, Pastor Wyland. Yes, and he has written basically a paragraph by paragraph analysis, biblical analysis of the U.S. Constitution, and also now a new one coming that just came out on the Declaration of Independence. So be sure to pick those up. They're very, very enlightening. During the constitutional debates back in 1787, 1788, we had the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. The Federalists were the champions of the Constitution. The Anti-Federalists, led by Patrick Henry, were the opponents. And any thoughts on that, Pastor Wyland? Go ahead.
I can tell you that I love it when somebody brings up Patrick Henry, because Patrick Henry, because of his, probably more so than anything else, his Give Me Liberty speech that has been passed around and encouraged and excited a lot of Christians and patriots over the centuries, because he is such a hero to so many people, I love it when Patrick Henry comes up, because there's a lot they don't, you probably know about Patrick Henry. You know, Patrick Henry was an anti-federalist, and convinced that the Constitution would fail to secure and protect liberty. Patrick Henry, who refused to attend the Constitutional Convention as one of Virginia's delegates, declaring, quote, "I smelt a rat," end of quote, voiced his concerns at the Virginia Ratifying Convention in 1788. And I mean, he gave several speeches. Let me just give you a flavor from one of them, where he, at the Virginia State Ratifying Convention, which regrettably they did ratify it, regardless of what Henry had to say, but they should have listened to him. But here is what he said. "I say our privileges and rights are in danger." By the way, this isn't a continuing quote. There's some breaks here, but I just picked out portions that I wanted to share. He says, "I say our privileges and rights are in danger. The new form of government will effectually oppress and ruin the people, as it has." I've added that. "In some parts of the plan before you, the great rights of freemen are endangered. In other parts, absolutely taken away. There will be no checks, no real balances." And I'll add, as has been the case. I mean, he was prophetic in everything that I'm sharing with you here. He says, "There will be no checks, no real balances in this government. What can avail your spacious imaginary balances, your rope dancing, chain rattling, ridiculous ideal checks and contrivances? And yet who knows the dangers that this new system may produce?" Talking about the future. Boy, are we seeing what it's produced. "They are out of sight of the common people. They cannot foresee latent consequences. I see great jeopardy in this new government." End of the quote that I'm sharing with you. Now, in contrast to the Federalist failed predictions, and they have failed across the board, in contrast to the Federalist failed predictions, this and nearly everything the Anti-Federalist forecast about the Constitution has come true, even after the Bill of Rights was added. The Bill of Rights has been an utter failure toward keeping the national government and its criminal leaders in check. Again, only open your eyes and look around you and see where we're at today. America was sold down the river when the 18th century founding fathers replaced biblical responsibilities based upon the moral law of God for enlightenment rights. And in fact, nothing demonstrates it better than the Second Amendment. And think about this. The amendment with the wording "shall not be infringed" is the most infringed licensed and limited amendment in the entire 27. And furthermore, a future generation of our posterity is likely to see the Second Amendment whittled away entirely and replaced or repealed altogether. It's the inherent nature or danger of optional enlightenment rights versus non-optional biblical responsibilities, such as the following. It talks still in relation to the Second Amendment. How about let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword or today's equivalent in their hand? This honor have all the saints, praise you, Yah. Psalms 146 through 9. Or you should read 1 Timothy 5:8 as well. And I'm just using the second, I know we're not talking about the Second Amendment. I'm just using it as an example. But as an example, which is more potent, an optional right, which is the Second Amendment? So under the Second Amendment, you and I have the right to bear arms. Whereas, which is more potent, an optional right or a non-optional responsibility? 1 Timothy 5:8 says we're worse than infidels if we don't provide for our families. And that begins, of course, with spiritual and physical protection. So which is more potent, an optional right or a non-optional responsibility? Which is more likely to be infringed, licensed, and ultimately abolished altogether? Which did the pre-Second Amendment Americans look to for their authority to bear arms with little or no infringement? Again, just as an example of, you know, the Bill of Rights beginning with the First Amendment, the whole idea of rights is, in fact, it's an entirely unbiblical enlightenment concept. We can maybe get into that a little bit later here. But for anybody who wants more regarding the Second Amendment in particular, which I know we're not planning to get into, I would very much encourage that you listen to our online message called The Second Amendment, A Knife in a Gunfight. And it's a knife in a gunfight because it provides only optional rights, the right to do so, where God says there is no optional right here. You have a non-optional responsibility to protect your family. Hmm. And that's just an example of one place, the amendment with the word "he shall not be infringed" being the most infringed. And so you can imagine where all of these other nine amendments fall out as well. There is the Bill of Rights has been an utter failure beginning with the First Amendment itself. In fact, think about this, the First Amendment, well, let me read the first part of it. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion. Let me stop there for a minute. You know, a lot of people are concerned about, for example, the mosques that are being built across America. But have they ever considered, why are these mosques being built across America? Well, could it be because Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, meaning they did not establish biblical Christianity as the religion of the nation, as the early 1600 Puritans did? So Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Anybody, any God, you know, and what really baffles me, Oliver, is that There's probably no other component of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that Christians hang their hat on more than the First Amendment. And are they concerned about their posterity being proselytized to Allah or to the Hindus and their God or all of these? And yet they proclaim the First Amendment and its establishment of religion clause as if it's Bible, and when in fact it's the exact opposite. It's the religious freedom and Christian liberty. They act like they're the same thing. They aren't anything at all. Christian liberty, which is also known as biblical dominion, was sacrificed on the altar of religious freedom. We don't have biblical liberty anymore. Not biblical liberty, which is biblical dominion anymore, because it was sacrificed on the First Amendment's establishment of religion, or no establishment of religion, or prohibiting the exercise thereof. So it's, and there's much more concerning the First Amendment that and the other amendments, but particularly the First Amendment, that Christians need to wake up to, that this is not something they want to be promoting. You know, without the parameters of the Bible's moral law, the First Amendment has proven to be a toxic brew. For example, Amendment 1 condemns the prohibition of speech, whether spoken or written. Well, does the Bible prohibit free speech, or excuse me, provide for free speech, or does it limit speech? Does God allow for him and his name to be used in vain? I don't think so. The provision for Amendment 1, for example, for the United States citizens to assemble peaceably, that appears innocuous, doesn't it, to most folks? The provision for Amendment 1 and for United States citizens to assemble peaceably seems innocuous, but is it harmless to give sodomites infanticide advocates, talking about those who promote abortion, as it's called, and Satanists the right to assemble peaceably? Is that harmless? You know, if you're a proponent of the Constitution and a defender of Amendment 1, you must also champion the rights of such criminals and anti-Christians to assemble and promote their wicked agendas. And instead, the Amendment 1 is then used by the homosexuals and infant assassins that claim freedom of speech and the right to assemble to combat Christians from doing so. And we see it all the time. And yet pastors and Christians will turn around and promote the First Amendment, and particularly the freedom of religion, as if it's some great biblical concept. It's a classic case of Isaiah 5:20 calling evil good and good evil.
Hmm. Yeah. It's interesting with Patrick Henry. He also predicted, he said, if you pass this Constitution, approve this Constitution and pass it, there will be a great civil war within 100 years.
Yeah, well, that's right. I'd forgotten about that.
47 years ago. Yeah. Now, do you see, is there a difference between, you know, this passage in Exodus 20 through 24, there's a place in there where it talks about if you oppress a stranger, then, and it's very, and this is in a section that doesn't have any penalties attached, but other than God's penalty, because God says, if you oppress a stranger, I will kill you. It's really blunt. And we sometimes hear this, you know, that, well, in a Christian nation, you know, the non-Christians are going to be oppressed and persecuted and so forth. But do you see a difference between like this freedom of religion that you're talking about and freedom of conscience?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Uh-huh. Nobody's talking about taking away the freedom of conscience of anybody who comes here. Uh-huh. And in fact, if you think about it, it's an impossibility to regulate someone's conscience to begin with. I can't regulate your conscience and you can't regulate mine. Hmm. And so we're not talking about limiting the ability for one to consciously even worship whatever God they choose. But that doesn't mean that we should allow anybody to come into what should be a biblical nation to promote their gods openly. They can do whatever they want in the privacy of their own homes when it comes to this. But they would not be allowed, not if we believe in the First Commandment, to proselytize our posterity to their false gods. And that's where Deuteronomy 13 comes into play. He makes it very clear. You're not to allow this, even in your own family, and they're to die if they promote it. And so how can the First Amendment and the First Commandment be reconcilable? They can't be. They're the antithesis of each other. They're polar opposites of each other. And yet, again, as I said, America's more American Christians put their hat on the First Amendment than probably any other component in the entire Constitution and Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. So if you believe that God's First Commandment is still in play today, And I know there's a lot of Christians who don't believe God's laws and has anything to do with us under the new covenant. Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. There's, if my count is right, there's 37 New Testament passages that promote God's law as still applicable under the law. Now, it's not talking about the Mosaic covenant. We're no longer under the Mosaic covenant. We're also not talking about being justified by keeping God's law. But just because Christ came and did away with the Mosaic covenant and its added stipulations, such as the priesthood and the ceremonial laws and such, just because Christ came and did away with that, and he did, doesn't mean he got rid of, at the same time, his father's morality, God forbid, as reflected and codified in the Ten Commandments, their statutes that explain them, and the civil judgments that enforce them. Two different things. So we're not justified by the law, but the law has been made, God's law has been made as the law, what should be the law of the land when it comes to how we are individually and communally and nationally to conduct our lives. And when we do, then God says, well, I'll bless you beyond your, what you can imagine. And I again would point people to Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verses 1 through 14 that elaborates on the blessings of when we do it God's way, beginning with the first commandment, which does not allow for other religions to build their mosques and their synagogues and their temples to other gods and proselyte our children to them, but still allows for their own ability to have to do as their conscience desires for them in a personal sense. But there's two different things there we're dealing with, and both comport with God's law. God isn't going to force himself onto anyone. He may call you, and it's pretty hard to resist his calling, but he isn't going to force himself on anyone, and therefore he allows that freedom of conscience, but he does not allow for the freedom of religion as purported and provided for in the biblically seditious First Amendment.
Yeah. So when it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, so that's basically saying that a nation or the Congress, is religiously neutral, right?
It's saying anything goes.
Yeah.
And the principal religion of America, and don't fall for this separation of church and state, or what I like to say, religion of state. There is no such thing. There is no vacuum when it comes to legislated morality in any government. Everything that's legislated is moral, or more often than not, immoral, as it is here in America. Consider constitutional paid for in utero infanticide, as I like to call abortion, or sodomite quote unquote marriages, and the list goes on and on and on. Don't think that there's any separation of religion and state. That is the figment of man's fertile imagination, or worse, the evil machinations of those who only intend for their religion to control government and society, and that being in particular secular humanism. And it is much, they admit, the secular humanists in their documents admit that it's a religion, and of course it is a religion, because it, in the end, if it rules or governs society or government, it determines morality, or more often than not, immorality. So there is no separation of religion and state. As so many, you know, and it's there in the Constitution as well. You know, you can't, no separation of, you know, the term is not used like people like to say. It's not found in the Constitution, the separation of church and state, or the separation of religion and state, but it's there in the Constitution, if for no other reason than that in Article 6, it rejects mandatory biblical qualifications. Morality is throughout that Constitution. It is not a neutral document. It is a moral/immoral document based upon what it promotes. And you cannot promote secular humanism over biblical Christianity or biblical God's biblical laws and think that that's a neutral document, as even some well-meaning Christian men have stated. And it's tragic that they have, because people have fallen into thinking this is a neutral document. They haven't read the document, and they haven't compared it or contrasted it or examined it by the Bible and its laws, as I have in BibleVersusConstitution.org, or excuse me, Bible Law versus Constitution, the Christian perspective, which is found on BibleVersusConstitution.org.
Right. So would you say the defining characteristic of a Christian nation is it's a commitment, a covenant commitment to order its criminal justice system by the law of God, and then in its founding document, and then a requirement to have a religious test of any office holder to adhere to that covenant? Or how would you define a Christian nation?
You know, more important, you said Christian test, and I want to just say, more importantly, to biblical qualifications, mandatory, according to the Bible, mandatory biblical qualifications, for example, such as is found in Exodus 18:21, Deuteronomy 17, and several other places as well. Mandatory biblical qualifications, a Christian test as found in the original state's constitutions is not enough. They were weak, and they did not eliminate what was secular influences, Enlightenment influences throughout even the state governments. A lot of people say, okay, I'm understanding the Constitution. Let's go back to the original state constitutions that had Christian tests in it. No, they were already. It was only 11 years later that some of those same guys then created the federal Constitution. Yeah, they're a little bit better in that they have Christian tests, but they're weak. They do not require the mandatory biblical qualifications that we find in the Bible, and they are inundated with all kinds of Enlightenment concepts. In fact, I'm kind of glad we got to this point, because, for example, in one of his many arguments on behalf of the Constitution, Madison revealed where ultimate power resides in a constitutional republic. Here's what he said. He said, quote, as the people are the only legitimate fountain of power. This guy's supposed to be a Christian? And he goes on, it is from them, the people, that the constitutional charter under which the quote unquote power, or I'm adding this, which the power of the several branches of government is derived. Alexander Hamilton stated it similarly. The fabric of American empire ought to rest on the solid basis of the consent of the people. That's humanism. Streams of national power ought to flow immediately from that pure original fountain of all legitimate authority. And it was no different for the state. I'll finish with this here. John Adams confessed the same humanism regarding the state's constitutions, wherein he said, it will never be pretended that any persons employed in that service, the establishment of the state constitutions, had interviews with gods or were in any degree under the inspiration of heaven. It will forever be acknowledged that these governments were contrived merely by the use of reason and senses. 13 governments of the original states thus founded upon the natural authority of the people alone. And if you go through the state constitutions, and I provide those quotes and the documentation and quotes from the state constitution, you'll find that for one example, Pennsylvania, 1790, Article 9, Section 2 says, all power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority. So don't think that we can go back to the state constitutions and make this right. We've got to go all the way back to the early 1600s and the governments of, by, and for God, established expressly upon his moral law and governed exclusively by biblically qualified men of God.
Yeah, Yeah, that there was this tendency to, well, you could trace that, what you just said, back to John Locke as well, you know, in second treatise on government, chapter 8, he defines real clearly that it's, any government in the world is to be defined by the will of the majority coming together and authorizing that government, and no mention of God whatsoever there. And I think even, you know, in some of this, like Rhode Island, for example, I think he referred to maybe a week earlier or so, but how they were relying on the law of God. But then, you know, when you come to the actual charter of Rhode Island in 1663, which was, I think, was granted by Charles II, they've removed that biblical qualification. It's more, you know, the saints of God may enjoy the peace, you know, if they walk in harmony or something like that. And they even within that short period of maybe 25 years or so, already they've degenerated to government based on natural law and reason and so forth. Well, I guess it's probably a good place to stop, Pastor Weiland. Really appreciate it, you being here. Could we maybe have you back in the future and have another, maybe in a three-part series on the Declaration?
Oh, I'm sure we could. You don't have to beg me.
Don't have to twist your arm.
No, not when it comes to God, His Word, His law, His our Lord and Savior in Christ. You want to talk about any of that? I'm game.
All right. Well, we'll get back to you on that. And thanks everybody for being with us today. And we'll look forward to seeing you next Tuesday. We'll be picking up with another of the classical authors and analyzing them biblically and helping us understand, you know, how it's all led to our current situation. So we'll see you then.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. For more episodes, visit greatbiblereset.com. And to help support the podcast and Kingsway Classical Academy, visit our sponsor at boomers-alive.com. To learn how to get your high school diploma and bachelor's degree on the same day, visit kingswayclassicalacademy.com and save up to $100,000 on college tuition,